You are listening to The Real Shia Beliefs, a collaboration between Thacker Lane and Al Hujah Islamic Seminary. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider becoming our patron by donating at thackerlane.org/support.
The second point here is, if we're referring to intellectual laws, why can't I engage in what is called tab'idh fi taqleed? Why can't I choose any qualified scholar and follow that scholar in whatever area I want? I follow X marji' in the book of Salah and the laws of Salah, but when it comes to financial transactions, when it comes to some other issues, I follow another marji'. I pick and choose. In the end, they're all experts. Why can't I just pick and choose? I am referring to an expert in every field, in every case. Why do I have to stick to one marji'? This is something that many people are asking today. How do we address that intellectually or rationally? You can? Well, the marji's are all experts in all fields. So given that they are experts, right? Now, they could be more knowledgeable in certain areas. See, the intellectual law states, if you know for a fact that this particular marji' is the most knowledgeable in the book of prayer and everything that has to do with salah, yes, you have to follow that marji'. You should follow that marji'. And if another marji' is more of an expert, is more knowledgeable in, let's say, the book of transactions, when it comes to interest-based transactions, modern transactions, the current financial institutions, banking system, if you know another marji' is more knowledgeable in that area, or another marji' is more knowledgeable in hajj, if you know that for a fact, of course you can do taqlid of multiple marji'. You don't have to stick to one marji'. But the question is, first of all, how do you determine that? Is it because the fatwa of that marji' is more convenient? The intellect rejects that. It's not about convenience. It's about what is the haq, what is the truth. So if I know, based on my own research or the expert opinion of a number of scholars, that this marji' is the best in this field, I can follow that marji', no problem. No marji' has an issue with this. So if we're talking about tab'idh, selective taqleed, in this, you know, framework, it's fine. We don't have an issue with it. And it's sanctioned by intellectual law, by rational practice. In the end, you're referring to an expert who's the most qualified in that field.
How do you know?
Either you yourself, you have some expertise, you can evaluate, like some students in the seminaries. They're not mujtahids yet, but they have some level of experience to be able to evaluate. Let's say I know this scholar studied 20 years the book of transactions. It seems they better understand the hadiths that have to do with business transactions. And that's my evaluation. Or I could refer to other mujtahids. And I ask them, out of all these maraji' that we have, who's the best in this book, in the book of salah, in the book of hajj? Let's say two just scholars, mujtahids, testify that X marji' is the most knowledgeable in the book of hajj, in the book of salah. I can follow that marji' in the book of hajj and salah, no problem. And this is sanctioned by intellectual law, and the maraji' today don't have a problem with this. In fact, they mention it in their book of rulings, that this type of selective taqleed is fine. Yes, brother.
So there's the book of hajj, there's the book of salah. What are all the other different categories that you have to take into account when trying to choose a marji' for example?
When we choose a marji', we need someone whom we are confident is the most knowledgeable in pretty much most of the fields or all the fields. Okay. That's the marji' who would be qualified for me to do taqleed of. But let's say I've chosen a marji'. I know in 80% of the rules he seems to be the most knowledgeable. But there's this one marji', I'm confident he's more knowledgeable in this particular field only. Let's say in medical issues, end of life issues. That's fine, I can follow that marji'. if that's proven to me with confidence that he is the most knowledgeable. That's fine. This is not something that's rejected by intellectual law. Yes, brother.
The issue that I see with this point, where if you are learned enough to determine which maja could be the more learned one, I mean, I see issues with that. And because if I am, for example, not in the vicinity of these majas, the knowledgeable folks, to go and get their opinion, I'm on perhaps a different part of the world. But I've been following the texts myself. So now I have built that confidence in myself. Now I'm going to determine, well, I read the text, and this is the one that I feel, my heart feels that this is the right one. So where's the validation process in that?
Now, when we say I've read the texts, which texts are we talking about? Is it just the Risala Amaliya, the Book of Rulings? Or is it their seminary texts in which they demonstrate how they arrived at that ruling? Makes a difference.
No, seminary texts, for example.
Because if I'm just taking the Book of Fatwa, some people do that, by the way. They take the Book of Fatwas, they put them next to each other. Okay, yeah, this seems to make more sense. On what basis are you saying it seems to make more sense? Did you see the process behind it? Did you look at the hadiths that were discussed, the verses of the Quran, the usuli principles, the jurisprudential maxims? A lot of people don't see that. They just put the fatwas next to each other. Yeah, this person seems to be more knowledgeable. That's a wrong way of assessing that. That's like putting two prescriptions next to each other and say, oh yeah, this doctor seems more knowledgeable. How are you making that evaluation from a prescription? Why? The way the prescription looks? The words he's put in this prescription? That's not a fair way to make that assessment. Yes, if one is a seminary student or seminary trained or qualified, he's taken the steps to know Islamic law, to know hadith, to know the Arabic language, to understand the principles of the Quran, and they're at a level where they understand what is called Bahth al-Kharij, which is the highest level in the seminary studies, and they look at the encyclopedias of these scholars, and they understand them well, yes, a student like that may be able to give an evaluation. I can put the works of this marja next to the works of that marja and see exactly how they took the steps to arrive at that fatwa. And I see that the first marja seems to be to have a better grasp of the laws and the rulings and in issuing the fatwa. Sometimes a lot of seminary students who are close to ijtihad can make that evaluation. But it requires expertise to even make that evaluation.
How do you determine you have that expertise?
Well, the one who studies these texts for years and years and years, and they do have an understanding of how the fiqh of Ahlul Bayt works, and also, they spend time with other scholars, with their peers, and they get feedback from their teachers and scholars that, yes, you know, you do seem to understand how the system works. You need that validation. I can't just sit 10,000 miles away in my own room and come up with that assessment. I need to be peer-reviewed. Well, how do you get peer-reviewed? In the seminaries, either your teacher will engage in lengthy discussions with you, and evaluate you and tell you, okay, you're at that level. You're not a mujtahid yet, but you understand what ijtihad is. Or you have other scholars who will give you that validation. So you need that feedback from someone. It's very important to get that feedback.
The one argument that is posed out there, Sayyidina, is that as far as the system of validation goes, has evolved over years for the past 14 centuries. And each decade brings in perhaps a new twist. Now, who authorizes this? Is it the Imam, the 12th Imam, who authorizes this evolvement in processes? Or is it just the average layman scholar out there who decides one year, all right, five scholars get together and this is the new thing that we will ingest in society? So how do we know that the actual Imam actually authorizes how it has evolved to this day where it is?
The Imams, alayhim as-salam, they gave us the major principles. The scholars study these principles and they basically make an effort to figure out how that principle is applied in their society. We have evidence when we talk about the hadiths that the imams approved of their companions doing exactly that. They give them the general principle, but then how is that principle applied to the conditions of your society? The imams trusted their scholar companions to do that. So the imams did sanction that. But the imams put guidelines. Make sure that these scholars are, first of all, qualified. Number two, they're pious. They're not people who follow desire. You can trust them. You can trust them with your religion. The imam stipulated this condition. So as long as that person is an expert and you trust their judgment, they're not influenced by their own whims and desires and temptations. They don't have any personal interests. The imam alayhi salam says, they are my hujjah. They are my proof. Doesn't mean they get everything right. They could get some things wrong. But that's the system that they put in place for us. But I have to do due diligence to know that they are qualified, they are trusted. They're not influenced by their desires. That's something important for me to research. So if these scholars, which in the previous step I've already researched that they are qualified from a knowledge perspective, number two, I can trust their taqwa. Whatever they decide and they inject into society, that's something that the imams approved of. That's the system they gave us during the ghaibah.
I don't mean to take more time saying no, but you see with these manajas, year after year, there's a new twist where there is now a conflict in that 10% or 5%. And that is echoing much louder within the average communities out there. How is it that these mirages do not come together and mention the fact that what you just mentioned, that for the most part, we are all on the same page for 95% of the rulings. Why is it that the followers of these mirages are ready to just jump at each other's neck for a certain thing?
A lot of political factors do come into play. Remember, there are political forces wanting to divide the Muslim Ummah and specifically the Shias. They will actually pay people, they will run media campaigns in order to give that image that the Maraja are fighting one another and that it's just there's just chaos at the seminary level and at the social level. So there are groups wanting to take advantage of that. So that 5%, they're amplifying it. Now the followers sometimes may not be the most God-fearing people. They're also driven by their own interests. They line up behind a scholar, that scholar becomes part of their identity, and it even becomes part of their ego. So when they fight for that scholar, or they're trying to defend that scholar, or they're putting down other scholars and followers, in fact, they're serving their ego. We'll talk about that later. In the religion of Ahlul Bayt, the Imams of Ahlul Bayt never told us take a scholar as part of your identity. A scholar is an expert you refer to in their fatwas. That's it. That scholar should not be idolized. That scholar should not become part of your identity. This is something we do find today happening, by the way. But this did not exist at the time of the Imams or even after the Imams like we see it today. So the Imams rejected this idea of scholars being idolized. That is why sometimes the Imams themselves would denounce certain scholars that they would see deviating a little bit. And some followers of those scholars were shocked. But this was a hard lesson that they had to learn, the followers of Ahlul Bayt. So sometimes people also don't understand taqleed. Some people, especially those who are a little bit ignorant, when they do taqleed of a scholar, that's it. That scholar becomes the symbol of religion. He becomes infallible. Everything that he says is holy. And I'm willing to go to war just for every thing that he said. That's wrong. That's taking it to the extreme. Respect the scholar, absolutely. They are the hujjah of God on you, the proof of God. But take them as experts, respect them as experts. But for you to idolize them to that extent is wrong. It's something not sanctioned by the Imams of Ahlul Bayt. And we never give the scholars the status of the Ahlul Bayt. Never. This is rejected. The Ahlul Bayt are infallible. You die for them. The scholars are guides. You sacrifice just like they sacrifice. Yes, we defend their institutions because they are a source of guidance, but they're never to be put by the level of the Imams of Ahlul Bayt, even though they are representatives of the Ahlul Bayt.
I have a question, yes. Not to deviate from the, if you don't mind. My problem is understanding, for example, I follow Sayyid Sistani.
some of the brothers I met during the Hajj, they said, well, you should look into Sayyid Ali Khamenei because of the thing is, he's the Wali Faqih. I'm not sure if I'm saying it right. Can you elaborate on that?
When we talk about the specifics of taqlid, we'll examine. Like, on what basis should you choose a marja? We'll examine that in detail, yes. So it will come in our next classes, inshallah. One other point about selective taqlid, or at-tab'id fi taqlid. Some people say, look, as long as the marja that I'm following is an expert, that's enough for me. So when it comes, for example, to some dietary requirements in Islam, I choose a marja who's a little bit flexible. So I'll eat that crab legs, I'll eat the lobsters. When it comes to nail polish, right? Maybe I'll choose the minority of scholars who say it does not invalidate the wudu. You can do wudu and you can have the nail polish on, right? For instance. And I just pick and choose. In the end, in every single fatwa, I am referring to an expert. Someone who's qualified. Where's the problem? The problem with this type of selective tab'il is that if you go to each scholar and you take their flexible laws, right? Or their unpopular fatwas, you have confidence that the religion now that you're practicing is a religion different than the religion of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them. Because see, each scholar will have some fatwas that are not common, that are not popular in the seminary. Each scholar, it's a given, right? Maybe 5% of their fatwas, 1% of their fatwas, maybe they're a little bit unusual, not that mainstream. It's a given. But once you collect from each scholar what's not mainstream, you end up with what? A collection of not mainstream fatwas. That gives you confidence this is not the deen that Allah wants for you. I'll give you an example. Each doctor, each physician, maybe in 90% of their judgments, of their understanding of medicine, they're mainstream. Maybe in 3%, 5%, they're not that mainstream. They could, you know, come up with this diagnosis that's not really popular amongst medical experts. Okay. If I have 100 doctors before me, I go to the first doctor and I take that 5%, which is not mainstream, this new twist to diabetes, let's say. And then I go to the second scholar in medicine, the second doctor, and he has this unusual understanding of cancer, let's say. And I take that. And from each one of these doctors, I take that which is unusual and not mainstream. Now when you end up with all these medical opinions, would you feel comfortable by going with this new baggage that you created for yourself now? See, in each item, you have a doctor who said it. There's no doubt about that. Some expert has that opinion. But when you collect unpopular opinions and you create this new thing for yourself, you know for a fact that you're taking a dangerous path. You cannot rely on this new baggage which you just created. Yes.
Why aren't we allowed to do the opposite of that and just find what the scholars are majority, agreed upon? And let's say, Marja A has this uncommon opinion, so I go with, well, the majority of the other scholars, the other Marja, they say the other opinion. And then, just go about.
If the majority gives you confidence that they are the experts, they have more expertise, obviously you can do that.
Well, maybe they don't give that kind of confidence, but at least you would have the confidence that, okay, I'm closer to what the Ahlul Bayt wanted because more scholars are agreed upon on all of the opinions.
A lot of scholars do allow that type of taqlid, but it's very difficult. It's a burden that not many people can handle because knowing the mainstream opinion requires a lot of research. You have thousands of laws. Who's going to sit and tell you, okay, the majority of scholars have said this? And that means in every ruling, you're going to have to go with the majority, right? That is an added burden. If someone wants to take that burden, fine. That's one level of ihtiyat, one level of precaution. You can do that, definitely. In fact, one alternative to taqleed is to look at all the fatwas and take the most strict one. That way you know for sure you're on the safe side. You can do that. But is that mandatory? Scholars have mentioned this is not mandatory because it's such a heavy burden that the average person cannot handle. You cannot function properly with your daily activities doing this for every single fatwa. So that's definitely an option, but is it mandatory? Or is there a more convenient way maybe the imams gave us? As long as you trust the scholar and you feel that they are the most knowledgeable in most of the fields, just follow them. Yes, you'd like to exercise caution and go with the majority in certain areas, fine. Let's say your scholar says lobster is halal. Let's say. But the majority say it's haram. Go with the majority. There's absolutely no problem because you're taking a more cautious path. But is it mandatory to do that? That's the discussion. So you see the problem with picking and choosing the fatwas from all these experts, even though we recognize them as experts. Even if we say it's not mandatory to follow the most knowledgeable, just follow any expert. But if you take the fatwa that's convenient, that's unusual, that's not mainstream from each scholar, what you end up with is problematic. What you end up with is far from the truth. Do you see the idea here? Or do you have any objections to this? Any objections to this point? Because today there is a big movement that's pushing for this. Choose any scholar in any field, in any fatwa, as long as they're experts, go with their expertise.
Saying that, doesn't that mean you have to know all their fatwas?
Yes, that also requires that you do know their fatwas, sure. That in itself is something maybe a lot of people are not willing to research.
What about if your intellect is convincing you that you're thinking of a certain ruling along the lines of what your intellect is dictating to you? You find two scholars and you think, there you go, the fact that I'm thinking this, and there are two scholars who are considered scholars support this too, I must be right.
But why are you thinking this? Because of convenience? Because of what?
Because of conviction that I have read a few things and it makes sense logically when I compare it to... Because it comes down as far as Western philosophy goes versus Eastern philosophy. There are things that you look in different contexts. In one context, something could make sense, which is the exact opposite of the other side.
What needs to make sense is always the general principle. Taqleed making sense, yes, it should be rational. But when you get to the level of detail, that's not an area where logic should be implemented. That's how our religion works. When you look at the fiqh rulings, right? Stoning the devil in Hajj, the rak'ahs that we have, the way you do them, is that something that you subject to logic? If a marji' says the takbira should be done this way, another marji' says a different way, is this an area where my logic can have any influence? In the details, logic should not have any influence. Logic, yes, when it comes to the main principle, why you do taqleed? Are you following the most learned? Logic over there can be exercised. But once you come to the application itself, logic cannot be used over here. That would be unfair evaluation. So even if you read a few things about a certain fatwa, that in itself is not enough to tell you, okay, this scholar is more of an expert. You have to look at the sources which the scholars examined and the mechanism they used to issue those fatwas. That's key. That's what's important. Yes.
So let's say, for example, that I'm following a marji' that I believe is the most knowledgeable and I agree with like everything, and then that marji' comes out with a fatwa that like just does not make sense to me. Would that mean that I can't follow that marji'?
No, you should still follow that marji'.
But what if I...
Because why doesn't that fatwa not make sense?
Like, for example...
Because you've studied Islamic law and hadith and Quran for 20 years and you're an expert and you can see that it's fallacious? If that's the case, sure, no problem. Is there an expert scholar who showed that to you or no?
Like for example,
Afwan, we have to go to the salah. وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين